Mentoring Solutions Proprietary Limited does not hold an Australian financial services license and does not purport to offer or provide financial advice. The information contained in this recording does not constitute specific financial, accounting, tax, legal, or other similar type advice. We strongly recommend that you liaise with your own financial, legal, accounting, and other advisors to ensure that the concepts contained herein can be tailored to your specific needs. Mentoring Solutions Proprietary Limited does not accept liability for any loss, damage or expense incurred by you if you rely on or utilise any of the methods, techniques or ideas discussed within this recording.
Hi and welcome to the Results Mentoring Webinar Room. We'll be joining you shortly. This is an automated message just to make sure that all the equipment that you have is set up correctly. So if you can hear this, sit back, relax and enjoy. Hi and welcome to the Results Mentoring Webinar Room. We'll be joining you shortly. This is an automated message just to make sure that all the equipment that you have is set up correctly. So if you can hear this, sit back, relax and enjoy. Hi and welcome to the Results Mentoring Webinar Room. We'll be joining you shortly. This is an automated message just to make sure that all the equipment that you have is set up correctly. So if you can hear this, sit back, relax and enjoy. Hi and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Brendan Kelly and I'm joined in the studio today by Simon Buckingham. How are you, Simon?
Very well, thank you, Brendan. Hello to everybody listening today.
Welcome one and all. Thank you very much for joining us. Today's topic, deflating the bubble myth.
It is a very contentious topic at the moment. There's a lot of talk in the media around property bubbles, prospects of some sort of bursting and a crash in property prices in Australia. Affordability supposedly being at all-time lows and being unsustainable in its current form. The reality is often very different, and today we're going to be debunking a lot of what's out there in the press and trying to give you some good, solid, common sense answers to what is happening in the property market right now and where it's headed.
Something very exciting for us, The Real Deal. Our first book is just about to land on the bookshelves. 14 Real Investors, 14 Real Deals. How will this book support people, Simon?
Well, the book was written with a couple of purposes in mind. And one was to really show people a different way of investing in property to the way the majority of people do. Because as we'll discuss today, and as a reader of the Sophisticated Property Investor newsletter, you may well already be aware, many people invest in ways that don't really deliver financial freedom in any kind of reasonable time frame. And so the book was written to give insights into different strategies that readers could take on when it comes to property investing in order to both save costs and make money and find their own path towards financial freedom. And so it outlines these 14 different strategies using real-life, real investor examples from very recent times to show how people are making money in the current property market in non-traditional ways.
The reason we're excited is because it is a contribution. It's a book that you can apply in your own lives. There are tips and tricks along the way to get you on a path to financial freedom that will serve your own needs and goals. The book itself, though, is also a contribution. All profits and proceeds for this book go to charity. We have a relationship with a company called White Line, and White Line are a charity organisation that support youth at risk in Australia. And we want to support the people in our own backyard. So please, if you have a heart to contribute, if you have a heart to learn, this book's for you. The RBA is meeting again next week. Simon, tell me about your thoughts on what you think the RBA will come to conclude this time.
All right. So just so everybody's on the same page, the Reserve Bank of Australia meets once a month, first Tuesday of every month, to make a determination on whether the cash rate or the base interest rate that then flows into the variable interest rates that people pay on bank products like mortgages and personal loans and credit cards, whether that interest rate is going to go up, down or sideways. It's always of interest to look at what the Reserve Bank is thinking, read their commentary and see what that might mean for us as property investors. So they are meeting next week, and having held rates level for a few months now, we're now looking at a heightened risk that the RBA might actually increase interest rates. Not dramatically, but we're probably looking at a 0.25% basis point increase in the interest rates, either in October or potentially November, certainly before Christmas. Now, why would they do that, having held rates on hold for a while? And you've got to understand how the Reserve Bank works. They're always looking to contain the rate of inflation within their mandated range, is 2 to 3%. If you know anything about the Consumer Price Index, which is an index used to measure the price of a basket of goods and services over time, if that index starts to blow out too high, if the rate of inflation starts to go up too much, then we'll end up paying lots more for goods and services. It's a dangerous spiral that can get out of control very easily, and it can cause damage to the economy in general. So it's something that the Reserve Bank is mandated to keep under control. And they do so by changing the cost of money. So they make money more expensive, in other words, interest rates go up, or less expensive, interest rates go down. And that will either stimulate spending or take away from spending. Now, they're not doing this to be mean. They don't do this just because they want to punish people, especially going into Christmas. You know, don't buy all of those nice Christmas presents and yummy goodies going into Christmas. It's more about controlling the economy and keeping growth at sustainable and manageable levels. And so there's a lot of stronger economic data that's been coming out recently. We've seen the rate of unemployment dropping, so more jobs are being created. There is stronger data around economic growth. The Reserve will quite naturally be concerned about the impact that all of the recent government spending from the stimulus is going to have, and also the impact of Australia's mining boom in terms of the amount of money that's flowing into people's pockets and how they might spend it. And the more people spend, the more people buy, the greater the upward pressure there is on prices, and that's what the Reserve's trying to keep under control. So, given the strong economic data of late, there is a heightened risk that we'll see a rate rise this month or next month. Now, what does that mean for property investors, Brendan?
It means they need to be careful of their numbers, and it'll take money out of people's pockets. Now, if you've factored some interest rate rises in there, you're just playing according to the plan. If you've purchased at an extreme level and you couldn't afford any more, you might be facing some difficulties. Mm. Given that there's less money in the economy and less money in people's pockets who already own houses, the demand for houses may in fact fall and therefore suppress any over expenditure and keeping inflation within the realm that the RBA wants to keep it on, serving its purpose.
Exactly right. Now, we've got to keep all this in context as well. We're not talking about a 1% or 2% increase in the interest rates that's, you know, going to put people to the wall. We're talking about a small, probably 0.25% increase. So an extra $20 or $30 on most people's mortgage repayments. So not massive, but certainly if you see a series of these rate rises in succession, as we did earlier in the year, you do get this suppressive effect on property prices because fewer people can afford as much when they go to buy property. So it is something to keep an eye on. But I don't think we're looking at anything too dramatic. I don't think we're looking at a rapid series of rate rises over the next few months. It's pretty much steady as she goes, and the Reserve Bank just trying to keep a bit of a lid on inflation and just keep people a little bit cautious about their spending.
Now, we'll get more into details around that in the not-too-distant future as the conversation progresses, but let's get straight into the main topic. What is a property bubble?
That's a very good question, Brendan. It's the sort of thing that great headlines to sell newspapers are made of. You'll often see a headline screaming that property prices are predicted to fall by 10% or 20% or 40%, as some commentators have come out with in recent times, on the basis that there's somehow been this bubble of an artificially high set of prices on property across the country that's grown and grown, and it's just like a balloon getting more and more air into it. Eventually it's going to burst and collapse. And the fear then is that, okay, if I buy a property now, if this bubble already exists and suddenly it bursts, I'm going to be left, you know, owing more on my mortgage than my property is worth. And in fact, we've seen this in the US of recent times. So following the subprime crisis and the onset of the global financial crisis, you had a whole lot of properties that people had borrowed very highly to get into. So they'd leveraged themselves up. They'd been given loans that they really couldn't afford, really should never have been given, but that enabled them to go and buy properties. And there was a lot of demand and prices went up because it was easy to buy, easy to get borrowing. And so those prices inflated to the point where they became unsustainable. And with defaults on the subprime loans, we had this domino effect and the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and it all led to the GFC and property prices imploded. The arguments about a property bubble are often based on a concept of affordability of houses, and specifically on a ratio of the price of a house to a person's income. And they take that and they extrapolate it right across the economy. And so it's, if you look at median house prices in the 1980s and average incomes, back in the 1980s, house prices were about three times the average income. So if the average income was, say, $40,000, house prices would be around about the 120 mark. Now, these days, that ratio is blown out, and it's the ratio of house price to average income is now, at least in the major cities across Australia, about five times.
So if you had an income of $40,000, then the house price, relatively speaking, according to that ratio, would be
$200,000. Now, incomes have obviously increased since the 1980s, so you've gone from incomes sort of around the $40,000 mark to incomes that are approaching $100,000. And so prices have gone from, you know, the low, mid-100s to $500,000 and more. Now, that is put forward as an argument by some commentators to say, well, we're in a bubble, this is unsustainable, housing affordability must collapse back to long-term average levels, so it must go back down to that three times income level.
And in isolation, you'd think that's an arguable point. But this is not an isolated argument.
No, and this is what's often overlooked, and certainly in our 30-second soundbite society, your headlines and your newspaper articles and your 30-second slots on TV don't go into the detail of what housing affordability actually is. It's far more complex than just the ratio of a price to income. This argument that Aussie house prices are somehow significantly overvalued because these house price to income ratios are unsustainable is fundamentally flawed, and it's flawed for a couple of reasons. One is that it ignores a fundamental driver of affordability. Now, what do most people have over their home, Brendan?
A mortgage.
A mortgage. So it's borrowed money. Now, that borrowed money comes at a cost, and that cost is based on interest rates. And so one of the key elements of affordability is the cost of money that's used to buy the house in the first place. And so you can't just look at the ratio of house price to income. You also have to look at the cost of money, the interest rate.
So you had an argument back in the 80s, it was 1 into 3. What were the interest rates back then?
Well, the average interest rates across the 80s were more like 14%. And you know, rates got up as high as 21% for a short period of time back then. So, you know, that's high compared to what we're used to.
And today it's around?
Well, for the last 10 years, the average interest rate's been around 7%.
So the cost of money is halved.
Correct. So you have all of these factors that you have to take into consideration together. So we've had interest rates halving from, say, an average of 14% in the 80s to an average of 7% over the last decade, combined with incomes increasing, which means that affordability in terms of your ability to service the debt on a property at current median prices, is actually roughly similar now to what it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Which blows the affordability argument right out the window, which also therefore affects the whole, we're in a property bubble and we're going to crash.
Well, that's right. It's actually quite arguable that the with this change in interest rates, the cost of money has been capitalized into the current value of property in terms of the prices, and it's actually quite a sustainable set of pricing. Now, there is a but, and there always is a but. The missing piece of the puzzle in all of this, and the reason why I think there's quite a perception that houses are unaffordable, is that you still need to come up with some sort of a deposit. So say you can borrow 80 or even 90% of the value of a property, you've still got to come up with the rest. Now, something that as an observation that's happened in our society over the past 20 or 30 years is that we've become really, really bad at saving. We're not a particularly frugal society. We live for now, we live on credit. And so that then creates an affordability issue. It's not the price of the property per se, it's the amount you've got to save for the deposit. And it's certainly not the borrowing, because based on incomes and interest rates, even with the higher property prices, the affordability in terms of debt servicing is roughly similar to what it was back in the 80s.
It's just people's inability to save right now that's the real problem.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, so the RBA have come out with a report recently.
Oh, yeah, sure. There was a report just last week, an actual case study on the Australian property market and how it relates to monetary policy and the way the RBA's behaved over the last decade or so. And it makes for very interesting reading if you can take 61 pages of RBA analysis. But I'd suggest if anyone listening to this has got a bit of an interest in economics and the property market and how everything works together and how monetary and fiscal policy works together with that, which I know you do, Brennan. But anyone with an interest in that goes to the RBA website, which is rba.gov.au, and downloads that report. But one of the interesting points that is made, and it's even made right at the very, very end in the conclusion, is that housing affordability in the RBA's view has actually remained quite stable over the last half of this decade.
So you can say, so you're telling me that people can download this report, ignore the first 60 pages and read the last one and they'll come up with
the
answer.
Just read the last paragraph. Yes, it might be a bit thin on the analysis for doing that, but sure, why not? But the point there is that when you actually look at the very extensive analysis that's been done and looking at trends and looking at these ratios, but more importantly, looking beyond just a basic ratio like price to income to see, well, what other factors are at play, affordability isn't really the big issue that it's often made out to be by some analysts and sometimes in the press. And we need, as investors, to be smart about the way in which we read and understand what's coming out of the press and read analysts' reports and read through it.
So, look, what are the drivers of prices? What are the drivers of price fluctuations in a market?
Well, if you recall back, I don't know how many people can remember economics in high school or in their first year at university, but economics 101 is all about supply versus demand, right? If you've got more supply than demand, the price of a product, in this case property, must go down. Oversupplied, fewer people buying, price gets bid down by the suppliers, in this case property vendors. On the other hand, though, if you've got more demand for the product, or property in this case, than the supply, then the buyers vie against each other and bid the price up, and so prices go up. So oversupply, price goes down. Undersupply, greater demand, price goes up. Now, this applies to property just as it does to anything else in the economy.
Now, of recent months, we've had a lot of conversation over webinars and to the results participants about supply and demand, and we've been highlighting for quite some time a supply shortage from a macro perspective. Look across the country and there is a shortage of supply of dwellings. Have you got those numbers handy about the sort of magnitude of the problem?
Yeah, I won't belabor it, but just to summarise, basically the way in which the supply of property works is it's all reliant on, well, two things. One is people being willing to sell a property or to provide a property for rental. But more importantly, the release of new housing or new dwellings into the market, which basically means you've got to build stuff. So if you look at some of the key indicators around housing supply, what we're really looking at is new housing construction. And in very recent times, private sector approvals for housing construction have actually been weakening. And dwelling completions, so finished houses coming onto the market to increase the available supply of housing, are expected to peak over the next 12 months below about 160,000. Now, that sounds like a lot of houses, but what you need to understand behind that is that if you look at the way in which population has grown and continues to grow versus the availability of new housing coming into the market, we really need, and the estimates are that we really need around about 200,000 new houses coming on the market each year just to keep up with that demand. So we're well short of that in terms of what's expected to come onto the market over the next 12 months and beyond.
So the conversation of supply and demand and the reports of dwelling shortages, that's a macro perspective, yep? That's something that is across the country. Does that mean it applies to everybody in every pocket?
No, certainly not. So if you're looking at your local hometown or suburb and saying, well, I don't see any kind of housing shortage here, I see dozens and dozens of properties just sitting there on the market, well, please don't beat us up because of that. This is a macro discussion, and it will always vary at the individual town or suburb level to some extent. But overall in Australia, yes, we have a chronic undersupply of housing, and that puts some supporting pressure, upward pressure on prices. And again, it comes back to this argument about the property bubble. You know, how sustainable are prices as they are? Well, if you've got an undersupply, that would tend to suggest that pricing is being pushed up by existing demand as opposed to pure speculation. Now,
hang on, before we go on, if we have an undersupply, implication is we should be in a boom. I mean, this should be one of the best buying times of the entire history in Australia. But before we go into that, let's go into some questions. Hi, guys. Won't an ageing population reverse this as we all downsize? Well, are we all going to downsize? Point one. Point two is you still need a roof over your head, so you're sure you might go to more efficient dwelling, meaning less backyard, smaller plots of land. So we'll move into constructed properties, but it still leaves, you know, your quarter acre block applicable for people who want to move into that. They may buy, subdivide that, and create more land opportunity as a developer takes control and puts more dwellings on that particular property. Sure. But is it enough to offset the population growth and the shortage of supply through bureaucratic planning requirements?
Yeah, and I'd suggest, you know, if you took a very, very long-term view, sure, you know, demographics will change over time. Aging populations, maybe kids staying at home later, that kind of thing. But in the medium term, that's not going to have an overnight impact, and we still need places to house these people. We have a net gain in terms of immigration and new births. So our growing population is coming from the births and immigration side.
By the same token, if we do find, and this is part of the beauty of economic policy that it's run by government, if the government does find that there is a oversupply of houses generating, despite the fact that we're underbuilding right now, if there is an ageing population that says we go to smaller dwellings and suddenly do have an oversupply of properties, they can simply increase immigration rates to maintain standards within the inflationary belt that they're looking to achieve.
Mm-hmm. So you've got to be cautious about looking too far out because there are so many variables in all of this. But what we can say, I think, is in the short and medium term, undersupply of housing is at fairly critical levels and is likely to continue. But that's not going to be the case in all sectors of the economy, and there's a question here on the webinar.
So is it a good idea to build new houses and rent them out?
So it's a very broad question, right? Good is relative to what are your financial goals. So what do you want to actually achieve? Are you looking for some long-term growth and a bit of rental income in the short term to help offset your holding costs, or are you looking to rent them out and sell them off to investors? There's a whole lot in that question. But is it a good idea to build houses in the current economy and the current property market? Look, I don't think it's a bad idea, but what you need to be very conscious of is your exposure to how the market might move in the short term. And so you'd want to be very conservative about your values on those properties. You would want to look at the numbers very closely in those deals and make sure you'd be happy to hold those properties for a period of time with slow growth. And we'll talk a little bit more about our outlook on the property market shortly. But I wouldn't bet the farm on a development at the moment. I'd be conscious that development finance is not the easiest to come by at the moment, although it can certainly be got. But I'd be looking for ways to manage my risk and my exposure to what might happen to property values in the short term around that.
Question, broadly speaking, was, is it a good idea to build new houses? Yes, if you're in a pocket of the market that says that there'll be demand for the property that you built at the back end of the project and they pay the price you expect them to pay. If they do, you'll walk away with a profit. If you choose to rent it and hold it on, great, the rental income will be there. It may be a negative yield scenario, potentially. You'll need to manage that process. You don't have to hold them to rent them out. If you wanted to ride a growth wave because you've done the research in the area, you know the pocket backwards and you know that there is growth pending, then by all means, hold on to them. But as Simon said, it's all relative to your goals and all relative to the financial path that you want to go down through property.
Mm. And just to wrap that up, the fundamental rule to remember here in terms of creating anything in property, whether it's a new house, a renovated house, a piece of land, whatever, is that only build it if the market wants it. You know, never build something just because you can. It worked well for Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams. Build it and they will come. But it's disaster for property developers. So don't build a house just because you can. Build it because you know that there is demand in that local pocket for that product.
Question, what time frames are you using to determine short or medium terms, 5 years, 10 years?
Sure, that's a fair question. It's a bit loose, but short term for me is probably 1 to 3 years. Medium term would be up to about 5 years. Long term would be beyond, 5, 7 years beyond. Really, it's again, it comes back down to your goals in terms of how long you want to be in a particular property deal.
Also depends upon your perspective depends upon the strategy you're taking on. If you're taking on 3-unit developments, a short-term goal would be right, 1, maybe 2 developments. If you're taking on a renovation, which is 6 months, a short-term goal might be a 6 or 9 month goal. Mm. So it's all relative to the strategy as well. What projects are you taking on?
Right.
Back to the main topic.
Yeah, so we were talking about how the supply and demand drivers in terms of the fundamentals of property will vary from one sector to another. So you might have house and land packages out in the outer suburbs, or you might have, and something that's been very popular in recent times, apartments, new apartments in the CBD. Now, something to be very, very careful of in the current market when you're thinking about the supply and demand and how it might affect the value of your investments is CBD apartments right now. There are just so many, literally thousands of new CBD apartments in high-rises that are coming online over the next 2 or 3 years that are based on off-the-plan sales over the past few years and more off-the-plan sales going forwards, that there's a real risk in my mind of a glut of apartments hitting the market. Now, you might say, well, isn't there a housing shortage? Isn't this good that all these new apartments are coming on board? Yes, but you've got to remember that's one segment of the market. That's not the entire market, and not everybody's going to live in or want to rent in a unit or an apartment in the CBD.
And there's not 200,000 of them being built.
No. So the issue here is you know, if you're speculating, and this is the danger in speculation, if you're speculating on buying an apartment now off the plan because you have to put very little money down, and it's probably not going to settle for, say, 2 years, and you're hoping it's going to go up in value in the meantime, well, what do you think is going to happen to the value of those apartments if 1,000 other similar apartments that are all but identical come online in the CBD at exactly the same time? Supply versus demand, economics 101. And this is where people came really unstuck at the turn of the century, back in the early 2000s, where in a lot of the centres around Australia, a whole lot of apartments really hit the market all at once. They all completed at once. And a lot of people had bought those off the back of certain property spruiker seminars and other things. But they'd bought them with the idea of, I'll buy this now, it'll go up in value while I hold it, and then I'll actually sell it before I have to settle. I'll make a tidy profit on the way through, never actually own the thing and flick it on to somebody else because it'll have gone up in value. Unfortunately, for many people, the apartments actually went down in value over that period of time, and many people found they couldn't settle and went to the wall. So the supply understanding of supply and demand is important, but you have to apply it into the sector that you're looking to invest in. What is happening with supply and demand in this sector?
Question back to the chat room. How do you know if a town needs new houses?
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. Well, I would say, Brendan, that you start off by looking at what's actually selling. So are new houses turning over quickly? Do they hit the market and then they're gone? What's happening with the population in that town? Is it rising, stable or falling? Obviously, if it's stable or falling, the underlying demand for housing isn't really necessarily there. But if the population is rising, and more importantly, if the rising population is largely people with jobs and money, income to spend, then that's a good strong indicator of underlying demand for housing.
Towns have a source of income and need a source of income in order to survive. So you need to ask the question, well, what sort of town are we playing with? Are we talking something in a population of 10 or 20 with one main industry service provider? Or are we talking about a town of 50-odd thousand where there is a whole pile of different smaller industry service providers that are providing income for the town? What's going out of the town that people are paying for that brings money to the town? Now, if you've got an environment where the town is growing in value because of the infrastructure that's going in to support industry around the town. If you say you're in a mining boom, or farms are wet again, so therefore we can grow stuff, and therefore we can sell stuff, and therefore farm incomes will go up, therefore they have more money, therefore more money will go to town, more money in town, more infrastructure attracts more people. So where is the money flow that's occurring for the town wholeheartedly as an overview, not so much as what's happening in my street or what's happening in my little plot of land. So it's an equation, as Simon said, of demographics, of activity in the town and infrastructure in the town, cash flow through the town. If it's growing, great. People are going to want to be where the money is. So keep your mind out for how much is available and what room population growth and trends have been in place. Mm. If the trends are up and rental values are really, really high and vacancy rates are in 1% or less, if all the indicators around the town are that things aren't staying on the market for long, they're staying on for a week or 2 weeks, real estate agents are screaming for properties, give me a listing, I need to sell something. If you're in a situation like that, then you know demand is high, and building an additional development of 1 into 2, 1 into 3, 1 into 4, they will get purchased. So look for the indicators of demand.
That's right. It's all supply and demand again.
So let's go back to, well, why aren't we in a boom? Yeah. I mean, if all the indications are that we've got a housing shortage, we've got a population that's got a bit of cash, we can afford it, the same affordability as back in the 1980s, affordability isn't a risk, why aren't we in a boom? What are the negative influences that are saying we're in bust or are in the potential we're going to crash? Why is that there?
Why aren't property prices going up strongly at the moment? Well, there's one thing that drives the market in the short term, and that's sentiment, basically emotion. Property markets are like any other market. You know, they're full of human beings, and human beings are emotional creatures at the best of times. And we're all subject to two primary emotions, fear and greed. And so when we're feeling greedy and optimistic, you know, we're more willing to jump in, take risks, buy stuff. When we're fearful, then we're more likely to sit on our hands and do nothing because we don't want to get burned. And so what we're seeing at the moment suppressing the market is largely an expression of fear. People are afraid of what might happen globally on global markets. You know, they hear the news coming out of the US and the high rates of unemployment over there and the falling house prices, and they go, oh, what if that happens here? What if something really bad happens, like a double dip recession in the US and ripples around the globe and brings around the end of the world?
Greece collapses, Iceland goes underwater,
exactly.
You name it, the world falls apart financially.
Yeah, now, I mean, we make light of it, but you know, a lot of people are wrapped up very tightly in these sorts of fears. I mean, a double-dip recession, Brendan, could it happen?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you Steve went to the US recently, and he came back with, ooh, and quite nervous, and with an anxiety around, you know, I think the US might be heading that way. Wasn't going to put a line in the sand one way or another, but you know, he might be heading that way, and we need to be mindful of that.
Yeah.
So if there is a double dip in the US, the question then becomes, well, how deep and how elongated, and what's the effect on other countries, because the US is one of the greatest consumers in the world.
Yeah. Now, you know, 10 years ago, Australia was particularly reliant on the US for, you know, its trade and exports and so forth. It's less the case now. Our primary partners in terms of the mining sector, which is really the heart and soul of the Australian economy, are China and India, which are both fairly strong economies at the moment. But does that mean we're immune to the US if something happens there? Well, of course not. You know, if it used to be that the US sneezed, everybody else caught a cold, and perhaps we saw that a little bit with the GFC. But we're more likely to contract a bit of a case of the sniffles than really catch pneumonia. I think being mindful about what's happening in other economies is a very different thing to throwing up your arms in panic and crying that the sky is falling. And yet we see in the media these extreme views of the end of the financial world is coming because the US is having some problems. And therefore we should all run and hide and bury our heads in the sand. And that's the wrong approach. What you want to do is be mindful of that and go, okay, if that happens, what are the likely consequences? How do I then invest in a smart way that manages the risk of that? Because with any investing, you can never invest without risk. Risk is always going to be there at some level, but you can manage the risk down and invest smartly, be more sophisticated. And so if you're concerned about a double-dip recession in the US and how that might affect global markets, well, think about, how quickly is that likely to come about? Maybe I should invest on a shorter-term strategy rather than bet the farm on a single buy-and-hold investment with my entire retirement savings and hope that it doesn't happen and hope that my property always goes up in value. Now, similarly, the global markets. Brendan, China. Tell me a bit about China. What's happening over there?
China was in a very, very high boom state, 15% plus growth.
Massive economic stimulus.
Yeah, it was huge. It was enormous. And that's what fed a lot of Australia's growth early in the 2000s. What we've had as a result of the GFC is a slowing of growth in China. It went from 15 to 12 back down to 8. Now, according to reports, the idea is that China is mandated an 8% growth.
You will have 8% growth.
You will have 8%. Now, if that's the case, then we've got a steady stream of a population and a significant population seeking demand of our raw materials. We are a raw materials provider fundamentally. Now, it was the mining boom back in the early 2000s that buffered us for the first phase GFC. If China mandates and is able to deliver on an 8% growth, then we will have a constant stream of demand that we can supply that will provide with us a buffer. Outside of that, you've got growth in India as well, and we're beginning to build trade relationships with supplying raw materials to India. So we're not so heavily reliant as a primary service provider or resource provider to America. We're more reliant on the providers of those products to America, which would be China and India.
Yeah, and there is certainly a very high internal demand in both of those nations to keep fueling need for resources.
Because they have an ambition to be developed worlds rather than underdeveloped worlds.
And massive populations too.
Yeah, which are still growing despite the one-child policy, etc.
Yes.
So with the demand, you're going to see a slowed effect as news trickles out should there be a double dip. My read is that we're not going to hit the same wall because of our economic fundamentals. I mean, right now I believe we're one of the enviable nations in the globe because of our strong economic position. If that's the case, we have room to move and to step back. I mean, we're at, 7% interest now. If it works out that people are scared and pull their heads in and they choose not to spend their money and put their hands in their pockets and hold onto their cash pretty tightly, which dries up cash flow in the economy, we have at least 6-5% to play with.
If you take the US example, maybe 6.75%, take it right down to 0.25%.
Before we're really in panic states. So we have a lot of latitude to stimulate growth or to maintain cash flow in the economy.
Yeah, there is a lot of risk mitigation there.
So what are the chances that we'll drop 40%? Really low.
Wouldn't that be
practically
great?
Really low.
Wouldn't that be great?
Well, if prices did fall down 40% and you cashed up, it'd be a stunning purchase time.
That's right. You know, houses within two clicks of the CBD would be positive cash flow.
Interesting point, though. If you look at what's happening in the US, you've got a flood of overseas investors going to the US today to go and buy $15,000 properties because they're there for cash flow purposes.
Yeah. It might not get any growth for the next 10 years, but
that's what they're doing. So, if if you're cashed up and prices in Australia fall that much, well, get in first. Anyway, that's beside the point.
We're straying back into the area of speculation, right? And this is where you've got to be very careful and just keep things in perspective. You look at what's most likely to occur. By all means, hear the extreme views, but always exercise a certain degree of cynicism on them and look for the more reasoned, moderate analysis, because that's what's most likely to happen. And certainly, whilst it's possible that we might see a GFC Mark II, we'd argue that we don't think it's all that likely. So this is, in the short term, this is one of the issues that's driving the market. Also, we did see quite a rapid rise in prices in a fairly short space of time at the end of last year and the beginning of this year. And so it would be expected not to be able to sustain, you know, ongoing annual rates of growth at 10% plus, which is what we've seen in some centres. I think Melbourne got up to 16% in a year. So that sort of rate of growth is unsustainable, and because it's outstripping the increase in wages growth, it's got to stop and take a breather at some point.
So the reason we're not seeing a boom sentiment really is there's fear around a double dip recession. We're nervous about global markets and the impact on Australia. We've talked about interest rates going up, therefore it's going to cost a little bit more and therefore becomes less affordable than it is today. We've talked about savings issues and people not having the cash to buy. These are the reasons why we're not in a significant boom right now. What indications might there be for us to say a boom's coming? Okay, what is it that we can do to look out for to say the next wave of growth is about to begin?
Very good question, Brendan. Well, I think if we come back to, for starters, the point we made about savings and the amount of a deposit that you need, one of the biggest variables that can impact how much you need to save for a deposit is how much you can borrow. And so if we look back at when the global financial crisis hit and banks really tightened up on their credit and lending criteria, the days of being able to get 95%, 97%, maybe even 100% lending on a property, so minimizing the amount of deposit you needed, disappeared practically overnight. And we went back to most lenders capping borrowing at 90% of the value of the property or the purchase price. Now, what we're seeing now are the beginnings of a shift. The pendulum's starting to swing back. And in recent months, we've seen a number of lenders starting to offer 95% lending, initially just to established customers, but now to new customers as well, and some banks even going up to 97% plus. Now, that obviously, like needing 3% to get into a property deal versus 20% makes a huge difference to the amount of savings that you need. And so as we see loan products like that start to become more widely available and credit starting to relax, that would be a sign that affordability, from the sense of I need less of a deposit, is increasing, and therefore more people can get into the market and therefore more demand for property, which could drive prices up again. Now, bear in mind that not everybody will qualify for those sorts of loans. It'll typically be people who are on a reasonable good income will get those sorts of loans.
At least for the foreseeable future, until they might go a bit overboard and the pendulum swings back way too far and then anybody and their dog can get one. But let's not go there right now.
A la global financial crisis in the US and exactly what happened there. Credit was too easy to afford, too much speculative demand, oversupplied, and then ultimately a crash. But we're not seeing that here.
And the topic of conversation is, what are the triggers to see the trends? So one of the triggers is LVRs are becoming more
relaxed.
Another trend. Simon, what is it that people need in order to service debt?
Money! Income!
So having more income, how does that work?
Sure. Well, there's, if you look back at how incomes change over time and how property prices trend over time, there seems to be a correlation between the rate of increase in property prices and the rate of increase in wages. And so it would be fair to say that if we see off the back of falling unemployment, coming off the back of the mining boom, people getting paid more in their jobs, that's likely to flow through into what people are prepared to pay for property, and therefore prices would go up. So, you know, our rate of wage growth is currently fairly low percentages at the moment, single digits. If we saw that start to creep up closer to, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10% wages growth in a year, you'd expect to see a corresponding increase in property values generally.
Because people would have more to service debt And therefore could afford higher priced properties.
Correct. And then if you combine that with more relaxed LVRs, it starts to paint a very stimulating picture in terms of property prices.
Now, another form of stimulant, and we've talked about interest rates in the past, about how raising interest rates suppresses stimulation. We're now, what happens in the reverse? If it works out that there is continued suppressive news around America and the global financial crisis and how it extends, et cetera, then there is the potential for the anxiety to sit in Australia. People put their hands in their pockets, don't spend. Government will feel potentially, or the RBA will feel potentially, the need to stimulate the economy. Another trigger then would be
a fall in interest rates. Now, wouldn't that be nice to see? But that's exactly what we saw off the back of the GFC, wasn't it? After a trend of rising interest rates, suddenly interest rates were slashed as a measure to try and prevent recession, and a fairly effective one on top of the stimulus that was coming out of the government at the time as well. So that could certainly make money cheaper and therefore people can afford more. On its own, I think in isolation, if it was all bad news and therefore interest rates are down and people's wages are frozen and if the credit gets tightened up again, it would have the opposite effect. You know, people would again just sit with their hands in their pockets. But if things are just sort of under control and inflation's well inside the 2 to 3% band that the RBA likes to see it in, then there is scope for rates to actually fall, and that could add some additional stimulus into the property market.
So all these things that we're talking about as forms of triggers for the next boom are all things generated towards creating cash in the economy. Increasing or relaxing your LVRs, increasing your incomes, or having more people employed, falling interest rates. Another trigger, though, in the property market specifically alone, would be rising rental yields.
Mm. And that appeals to investors. And so, you know, one of the things that we saw at the beginning of the more recent upturn in property prices sort of in 2009 across the major centres was a lot of first home buyer activity. They got a stimulant in the form of the additional grants, jumped into the market, helped to drive up prices, and then second homeowners got the benefit of that, were able to go and upgrade their homes, and then they were followed by investors, but not in terms of massive amounts of speculation. But as rental yields increase and therefore offset more of the holding costs of a property and provide a more attractive investment for the investor, you're likely to see more investors flowing into the market and then choosing to invest in bricks and mortar rather than shares or cash.
So the conclusion here, in essence, another boom is inevitable. It will come. And it's far more likely than a severe 40% loss type crash. So how can people apply all this information? It's all great and it's insightful, but how can people actually apply what we're talking about today? Yeah, Simon?
And certainly we want you guys listening to this to be able to take some value out of this and go and apply it in your day-to-day investing right now. And so here's the application of the information from our perspective. One is you should be expecting slow growth or even minor declines in property values in the short term due to the impact predominantly of sentiment in the market, but also of the recent hike in prices causing the market to take a bit of a breather. So in the short term, don't rely on market-driven gains. There's more downside risk, so there's more chance of you not getting a gain, in fact getting a loss. There's a risk of prices going nowhere or slightly down more than up in the short term. Now, as we mentioned with the inner-city apartments example, one of the things we would stress is that it's probably prudent to avoid off-the-plan apartments in the CBD, given the state of the market as at the moment and the risk of significant oversupply in that segment within the next 3 years.
Going back to the comment before, in the short term, what's in the short term in your mind?
I'd say, well, 2 to 3 years would be my outlook. I wouldn't be anticipating a lot of market-driven growth in the next couple of years. I think it certainly over the next 12 months, things will be fairly slow. Certain pockets will fall. Beyond that, things ought to start to pick up as the fundamentals kick in. But this segment of inner city apartments around the CBD is, to my mind, one of the higher risk segments to be playing around in.
In a recent exclusive conversation Steve had with results participants, sort of trend for flat to mildly declining and sometime around early next year, you would start to see a reversion of that into some gentle sort of growth. So as a flag and additional piece of information, throw that out there. What can people take advantage of?
Well, the thing about buyer's market, as you get into a market where there are potentially fewer buyers than sellers and therefore prices are suppressed and possibly even fall. In order to take advantage of a buyer's market, you have to do what?
Buy.
Yeah, it's a bit of a no-brainer, and yet it's the exact opposite of what most people do. And then they bemoan the fact that they didn't get into the market last year or the year before and look at how prices have gone up or look at how much money my friends made when they got in. And so don't be put off by a buyer's market. It's just the opportunity to buy. You know, if you're in a seller's market, you want to be a seller. But again, most people hang on.
It's a matter of reading the market and reading the triggers. We've attempted throughout today's conversation to offer some insight and offer some indications for triggers and taking action.
Mm.
Need to do some research in your own area relative to the strategy you're looking to take on to figure out what the appropriate triggers are, to look for them, be mindful of them, and then act. Mm. The trick here, act.
Now, are we suggesting that people in a market that's becoming more of a buyer's market should just blindly go out and just buy something for the sake of getting in the market?
Absolutely not. Broadly speaking, you want to focus on deals where there's scarcity, where you can add your own value potentially, but it's all relative to the strategy you want to adopt.
Mm. And that's because we're not relying on market-driven gains, certainly not in the short term. You know, you want to find a deal that's got inherent value in it. So you're either able to negotiate a very good deal on it and it's scarce. So that might be water views, that might be it's by the river, it might be that it's on a larger block and therefore will be attractive to developers down the track. Something that's inherently scarce about it that will help it outperform the general market over time, or something that you can do your own project to drive your own value into the property.
So we've started a conversation here and there's a whole lot more to go and a whole lot more depth we can throw into it. But we're out of time. Simon, what is it we can do and how can we get this information out to people?
Well, look, we've written a book exactly on this topic. So that was seriously, you know, check out the Real Deal. It's subtitled Property Invest Your Way to Financial Freedom, which is what it's all about. But it's all about the strategies that you can use to get yourself into a position where ultimately you can quit your job or have a more comfortable retirement, using strategies that don't rely on market-driven growth. And in the current environment, relying on market-driven growth is a fool's game. Now, you want to be smart about your investing. So that we've written this book to try and educate people in those strategies, those different ways of investing, and give them real-life examples in doing that.
But the problem is the book's not available till mid-August. So how can they...
Mid-August? I think that was last month.
Good point. Mid-October. So how can people... I mean, how can we get the message out now?
All right, well, one of the things that Brendan and I are going to be doing over the next month during October is we're actually going to go to Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane, not in that order, and spend an evening with anyone who's interested to sit down with us, and we're going to run through some of our thoughts on the property market and where it's headed, the mistakes that we would love to see people avoid in the current market that we see so many people making and just creating a financial disaster for themselves. We want to provide some education on these alternative strategies, raise the awareness of them, and actually help people, give people some real practical pointers on how to analyze areas and how to analyze deals like the professionals do, like we do ourselves in our own investing and like the people in the results program do. So we want to provide that, and we're going to spend 2 hours an evening in Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne. Starting with Sydney, I think.
Sydney on the
7th. 7th of October in the CBD.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be an evening event. And then we'll go to Brisbane on the 12th of October. And finally Melbourne on the 13th of October. Spend 2 hours with anyone who wants to join us. And anyone who comes along actually gets an advanced copy of the book as well.
Now, when we say anyone, we're not actually... This is not a... Expect an audience of 1,000.
Oh,
we're
no.
talking a fairly intimate group. I mean, we, by intent, don't want to have this huge, big event where, you know, it's a case of let's go for an intimate sort of conversation, give the people who are there anything we possibly can to support them in their own journey, and a book to take away to keep the study going, to keep the dream alive. I mean, the book's all about supporting what gets said. It's all about supporting you in the goals and objectives that you want to achieve. And we'd love for you to come.
Yeah. So please, if you've got, if you're in Sydney, Brisbane or Melbourne, Sydney on the 7th, Brisbane on the 12th or Melbourne on the 13th, we'd love to see you there.
So how do people get the details?
All right. Well, there's a web address. It's www.realdealbook.com. And if you go there, you'll find all of the information about these evenings and all of the details, timing, venues, and all of that. Now, there is a small price for these events, and the reason there's a price for these events is because we want to give some money to charity. We want to give some money to White Lion. And so tickets for the evenings are just a mere $39, and that gives you the free book as well. So the book's going to retail next month in bookstores at $29.99, so you're really coming along for $10. And we will be giving all of the profits from those evenings away to charity. And as Brenna mentioned earlier, all royalties from the book go to charity as well. And we want you to share this experience. You know, we encourage people and their partners to be supporters of each other. So it's always great if your partner is your greatest supporter and not your greatest detractor, we often say. So we'd encourage you to bring a partner along, and to make it easy, we'd like you to bring that partner for free.
Come along, enjoy.
So can't really make it fairer than that. But it's going to be an awesome evening. You know, we'll be there. We'll be presenting on the market and on investing strategies. We will take you through some real-life case studies that have been done where people have made, you know, tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of profits in their property deals in a very short time frame, and show you how they're making their own way towards financial freedom. But so please come and join us, and there'll be a great chance to have Q&A with us there as well.
Now, Simon, we need to go. We want to thank you ever so much for listening. It's been great. Closing thoughts.
Well, it's been a pretty big one. But I would say, you know, don't get caught up in the hype or the fear in the property market. It's so easy to get bombarded by headlines, to go along to a seminar and have somebody try to ram property down your throat, usually when they've got something off the plan to sell you. You know, what you want to do is take a step back and, sure, hear the opinions, but treat them as just that, opinions. Go and do your own research, get across multiple articles, look at different economic analysts' reports, and form your own conclusions about what's actually going on, and then invest accordingly. But there's only ever one time to invest, and that's today. So don't be afraid of being in the market. Just invest wisely.
My thought backing that is just research. The more you know about the market you're getting into, the more you know about the deal and the strategy you're getting into, the more you will be able to profit with less risk. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much for listening. It's been a pleasure to be here and to present this information to you. Come along to see us when we come and visit you in Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne. We look forward to it. Thanks and so long. Hi, and welcome to the Results Mentoring Webinar Room. We'll be joining you shortly. This is an automated message just to make sure that all the equipment that you have is set up correctly. So if you can hear this, sit back, relax, and enjoy. Hi, and welcome to the Results Mentoring Webinar Room. We'll be joining you shortly. This is an automated message just to make sure that all the equipment that you have is set up correctly. So if you can hear this, sit back, relax, and enjoy. Hi, and welcome to the Results Mentoring Webinar Room. We'll be joining you shortly. This is an automated message just to make sure that all the equipment that you have is set up correctly. So if you can hear this, sit back, relax, and enjoy.